from Ground Zero Radio. This is Democracy Now! Back from Exile.
They start dragging me, wrapping me in the banner and dragging me and kicking me. At one point, you could actually see the boot print between my arm and my face.
That was Philadelphia Republican Convention 2000. Next week is New York World Economic Forum 2002. The same man is leading both police operations, former Philadelphia Police Commissioner John Timoney. New York police vow to crush protests. And we'll talk to singer-songwriter-activist Dar Williams.
Hi, it's great to be back at Pacifica and to be on Democracy Now!
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Special Forces raided two Taliban compounds in the mountains north of Kandahar yesterday, killing at least 15 fighters, capturing some 25 others. Pentagon officials said the attack was one of the largest known U.S. ground combat operations of the Afghanistan war. President Bush told an audience of mayors yesterday he wants to double the nation's spending on so-called homeland security to nearly $40 billion. Bush said he'll ask Congress to set aside $3.5 billion to train, equip, and aid police, fire, and emergency medical technicians. That's 10 times the current funding. Bush emphasized these first responders in the so-called war on terrorism, but Border Control will receive the most money, some $11 billion. Noam Chomsky has become the target of Turkey's chief of terrorism prosecution. The authorities in Ankara are using anti-terrorism legislation to prosecute Chomsky's Turkish publisher. The publisher faces a year in prison for daring to print American Interventionism, a collection of Chomsky's recent essays, including harsh criticism of Turkey's treatment of its Kurdish minority. The Turks say the criticism is an incitement to violence. Chomsky's planning to fly to Turkey in February for the publisher's first court appearance and has already written to the offices of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. A Palestinian suicide bomber wounded at least 14 people at a Tel Aviv mall today. Meanwhile, Israeli troops shot dead two more Hamas members. The suicide bombing comes a day after an Israeli helicopter attacked a Gaza refugee camp, killing a senior member of Hamas, and after Israeli forces killed four other Palestinians in separate incidents. Meanwhile, USA Today is reporting President Bush's top foreign policy advisors will meet to consider sanctions against Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat for allegedly trying to buy arms from Iran. According to unnamed diplomatic sources, Bush's foreign policy team is planning to recommend sanctions that might include suspending the peacemaking mission of the U.S. Middle East envoy. The team could go as far as severing ties with the Palestinian Authority. USA Today added this could undercut Bush's anti-terrorism campaign by stoking anti-American feelings among Muslims already angry over U.S. support for Israel in its conflict with the Palestinians. The Australian government lifted its freeze on processing asylum applications yesterday after at least three refugees tried to hang themselves with bedsheets at the Woomera Detention Center in a remote area of southern Australia. The concession came after more than 200 Afghan refugees had mutilated themselves and spent 9 days on hunger strike. Some sewed their lips together in protest or gulped down poisonous cocktails of shampoo and detergent. 21 detainees were released after having their applications approved yesterday, but the Conservative government insisted it's not backing down. The Australian Prime Minister John Howard, in his first public comments on the protests at the detention camp, said he's determined to keep boat people off Australian shores. This news from Washington. Arthur Andersen, the accountant firm under siege for its role in the collapse of Enron, yesterday shifted the entire blame for the shredding of potentially crucial documents onto David Duncan, the partner it sacked last week. Under aggressive questioning at a hearing in Washington, a senior Andersen executive claimed Duncan had made the decision to destroy the documents without reference to senior members of the firm or to legal counsel. Thousands of records were destroyed as an investigation into Enron by the Securities and Exchange Commission got underway. Anderson was warned at the hearing not to hide behind a scapegoat. Duncan himself appeared at the hearing but refused to answer questions, invoking the Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate himself. The committee had declined to offer Duncan immunity in return for answering questions and said he was obstructing the investigation. The shredding of the documents, by the way, not only took place at Arthur Anderson, the accounting firm, but at Enron itself. And in rare defiance of the House Republican leadership, supporters of campaign finance reform legislation gained the upper hand yesterday when they gathered enough signatures to force a House vote. The Senate had passed the legislation last spring, but House Republican leaders have refused to let it come to a vote in their chamber. Lawmakers credited the Enron scandal with advancing the effort to ban unlimited soft money donations to parties. Enron gave millions of dollars to congressional and presidential candidates. And Colombia's military destroyed a U.S. government helicopter to keep it from falling into the hands of rebels who forced it down last week. Five police officers were killed protecting the downed aircraft. The crew escaped unharmed and included a Peruvian pilot working for the Virginia-based DynCorp. DynCorp is a State Department contractor that provides personnel for the so-called war on drugs under a $1.3 billion U.S. program of mostly military aid to the human rights abusing Colombian military.
God of the poor man, this is how the day began. He could offend inside Daniel Berrigan. Oh, and along the napalm, we pulled the draft files out. We burn them in the parking lot. Better the files than the bodies of children. I had no right, but for the love of you. I had no right, but for the love of you. Many roads led here, walked with the suffering. Tom in Guatemala, Philip in New Orleans. Oh, it's a long road from law to justice. I went to Vietnam, I went for peace. They dropped their bombs right where my government knew I would be. I had no right but for the love of you. I had no right but for the love of you.
Dar Williams, believe it or not, here live in our Firehouse studio. And the name of that song about the Berrigans?
I had no right.
Well, we're going to talk with Dar later in the program. Thanks. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. The law of the fist. New York police vow to crush protests against the World Economic Forum is our first subject next week. The World Economic Forum, or WEF, will hold its annual meeting in New York. That's from January 31st to February 4th. At the meeting, 1,000 of the world's top business leaders and some 1,000 political and media leaders come together to shape the global agenda. This year, the WEF says their meeting will focus on finding ways to, quote, reverse the global economic downturn, eradicate poverty, promote security, and enhance cultural understanding. Those who oppose the global financial spread say this translates to mean rescuing failing corporate giants, exploiting working people, and clamping down on dissent. Many say the World Economic Forum has chosen to meet in New York because the city's recent trauma of September 11th makes it a difficult climate in which to protest. Last year, when the World Economic Forum met in Davos, Switzerland, thousands came from across Europe to show their opposition. Richard Esposito's piece in this week's Village Voice begins, "Seen through the eyes of New York cops, the anti-globalization movement looks like one bloody line of terror and mayhem, stretching back to the Seattle riots of 1999 and heading right at them. If the protesters pouring into the city for the World Economic Forum at month's end have plans for creating more scenes of violence and destruction, the NYPD says they can just think again." The piece presents a militarized city prepared to take violent action against violent protesters. Is this the scene that you expect in New York? We're going to begin with Richard Esposito, who is a consulting producer for ABC News, reporter for Reuters, and co-author of the book Dead on Delivery, Inside the Drug Wars Straight from the Street. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Your piece is called Lockdown at the Waldorf. Can you describe the police plans for next week?
Yeah, the police plans in New York, there'll be about 10,000 police officers in Lower Manhattan, and their plan is to allow for peaceful protests. That's their normal plan, is to negotiate with civil liberties and arrange for places for people to protest. Their concern are what they say are about 200 activists whose methods are different in that they engage in somewhat violent protest. And that's what their concern is about, they say.
How are they preparing exactly? We saw some images last week, at least New Yorkers did on local television, of a Shea Stadium mock demonstration and police response.
Yeah, what you saw on TV in New York were cops in riot helmets with batons, emergency service trucks. And what they plan to do, they say, is to keep a space between anybody who might engage in violent protest and anybody of the 3,000 delegates to this World Economic Forum.
We're also joined in the studio by Kate Cooper. She's part of the group Another World is Possible and an anti-World Economic Forum organizer. What did you think as you saw the police preparing and police cadets chanting "No justice, no peace" in Shea Stadium and then getting moved in on by other police?
It was a little disturbing. I think it's very disturbing to see police preparing for what are largely incredibly peaceful protests. It's disturbing to see the police preparing for peaceful protests with such vehemence, such military-style tactics.
Well, let's talk about the people, the police, who are involved with the preparations. You've got some graphic pictures in this week's Village Voice, and you lay out who's in charge. Global anti-globalization protesters meet globo cops, you write. Richard Esposito, John Timoney, New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, Kroll bioterror expert Jerome Hauer, Madison Square Garden GM Michael Julian, Secret Service Special Agent in Charge Steve Carey, Diplomatic Security Service Regional Boss Patricia Kelly, Waldorf Security Chief. These are just a few of the resources New York has drawn upon. And you point out, of course, that John Timoney is the former Philadelphia Police Commissioner in charge of the Republican Convention 2000, and he is now CEO of Bodeedle Associates, a private security firm.
Yeah, I met with John Timoney yesterday morning at the Waldorf for breakfast. John says, you know, he was knocked down in Philadelphia. He saw young cops beat up. He said this was the work of about 100 people, although they had over 5,000 peaceful protesters in Philadelphia. And what the New York City police want to prevent is what happened in Genoa, where police actually killed a protester. They want to prevent police and innocent protesters, they say, from becoming enmeshed in any confrontation. And their understanding, based on visiting the other cities, is they say that this is a tactic of this somewhat violent minority who, I guess, take advantage in their eyes of the anti-globalization agenda.
I wanted to play for a minute the description of a protester at the Republican Convention 2000. Her name is Bork. We interviewed her, Juan Gonzalez and I, at the Independent Media Center during our coverage of the convention. She had just come in from the protests. We go to the videotape.
To the Independent Media Center, you have a serious shiner on your right eye. Your arm is bruised, and, well, we can't see what's under your pants. But can you tell us what happened to you?
Yes. I was peaceably demonstrating 2 days ago, and I was taking a banner into the street, admittedly to commit
civil disobedience in a peaceful way. I had a rather large banner. I had reinforced it with wire because it makes it less liable to tear when you have a cloth banner. And police got very upset when they attempted to cut my banner up.
What did it say?
It said, "Stop the Texas Killing Machine." They apparently didn't like the message being outside of a Free Mumia Abu Jamal rally. And when they attempted to cut it up and they could not get it to cut, the police officer became very angry. He started pulling on it. I had tucked it into the pocket of my pants to support it because it was a very heavy banner. And so when he pulled on it, he was pulling me off my feet. I said, "I can't get it out. I can't get it out." And he just pulled me off my feet. The two or three other cops ran up to help him. The next thing I know, they had pulled me completely down. They started dragging me, wrapping me in the banner, and dragging me and kicking me. I don't know if you can see it, but we actually have a boot print from... If you see, I had tucked, which is one of the demonstrators are trained to tuck if people are attacking your face. And you can, at one point, you could actually see the boot print between my arm and my face of where the, you know, the foot was. There's a boot print on my thigh also, and several bruises in other places on my body. I can't show you. It was very bad, and it was so bad that when they got me to the jail after they'd arrested me, but while referring to me as an it, get its arms, take, you know, put cuffs on it, which was sort of a Nazi thing to do. They had gotten me to the jail, and the person who had been driving the vehicle was so appalled at the way I looked, at the bleeding of my hands where my fingernails had been torn out while I was trying to stop them from dragging me so far. That he just said, "I'm going to take you to the hospital or back to the protest. Your arresting officer isn't here yet. You need to go to the hospital. Let me take you." And he took me. I thank that officer. Compared to the other officers, he was quite nice.
You said yesterday that he said, "I'm just too old for this."
Yeah, he said, "I'm just too old to deal with these young shits," referring to the other officers. Sorry.
So you went to the hospital, and you were not arrested because he brought you there.
Yes, I had been arrested. I was in cuffs. There was an arresting officer, but the officer who took me in the van was so appalled at the condition I was in, bleeding and whatnot, that he decided on the spot to take me to the hospital instead.
Brian Petruska, you're a paralegal with the R2K Legal Collective. Is Bork's story a typical one this week? 380 people arrested?
I wouldn't say it's typical, but it's very common. We've had reports of a lot of very excessive police beating, both on Tuesday and then especially on Wednesday. Wednesday in particular was characterized by that the police violence was largely, well, almost entirely unprovoked. We have reports of... by almost all regards, very peaceful demonstrations in which the police took it upon themselves to enter into crowds and pick out certain individuals to enact violence on, and in many cases, serious violence. We actually had a legal observer who are identifiable by hats, demonstrating that they are objective observers for legal purposes, and he was beaten so badly that he was sent to the hospital. We also actually had a report from Tuesday of a man who was beaten so badly that he had to have his ear stitched back to his head. And as a result, at arraignment, the judge was so appalled at how beaten he was that he gave him reduced bail because he didn't want him to go back to jail.
Just a clip of the coverage that we had of the Republican convention in Philadelphia. Now, John Timoney, who will be the number two person in charge here, though he is head of a private security firm, Ray Kelly, the new police chief, who was already police chief years ago in New York, has called him in for this precisely because of how he dealt with the demonstrators at the Philadelphia convention, hailed by many as a model of police behavior. What is your response to these on-the-ground descriptions from a year ago, Richard Esposito?
You know, her bruises are pretty bad. First of all, just for clarification, John Timoney's here for a private business firm. He's here to represent and protect executives. Ray was here for the Democratic Convention, and John. They were both in town. There was no violent arrest. There were no significant injuries reported. This is in Philadelphia. We have 600 demonstrations a year in New York City, and we don't hear too much of any kinds of problems like Philadelphia. You know, we've had some bad police responses over the years in Crown Heights, Sydenham Hospital, but they'd be the first to tell you they've learned from that, and their goal is the more people they put on the street, they think the less chance of any confrontation.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll also be joined by John Sellers. One of the police approaches in Philadelphia was what people called preemptive arrests. People were scooped up on the street, not doing anything, perhaps holding a cell phone, and charged with hit with charges and bails of, well, in John's case, $1 million. And many felt it was to prevent them from being on the street in Philadelphia and then to prevent them from being on the street in Los Angeles, which was the convention of the Democrats a few weeks later. We're talking to Richard Esposito. He wrote the piece in this week's Village Voice called Lockdown at the Waldorf, Cops Set to Flex Muscle at the World Economic Forum. And Kate Cooper, who is with Imagine Another World. Another World is Possible. Exactly what's the name of the group?
Another World is Possible.
Another World is Possible. We're going to go to Dar Williams for a music break.
Well, we're heading for a past that you can leave and not defend. Where the downtowns hold the future of, you can't go back again. So there you'll find the rusting debtors, motel signs with missing letters. And there's a monster on the outskirts, says it knows what your town needs. Then it eats it up like nothing, and it won't spit out the seeds. We can be the super shoppers, we can say we're really smart. And you can say your town is doing fine without a beating heart. You can even say the money saved is all your own. It's bought and sold. It's bought and sold.
Dar Williams live in our Firehouse studio, as well as a group of students who have come in with Deepa Fernandez. She'll be headed down to the Brazil Forum in a few days, along with producer Chris Abrams. We'll be bringing you a live on-the-street action, both here in New York at the World Economic Forum, inside and outside the protests, and in Porto Alegre, where the World Social Forum will be taking place. Tens of thousands of people from around the world gathering there to talk about alternatives. We're focusing on what's planned for New York after the Republican convention in Philadelphia. The police commissioner there, John Timoney, was widely hailed in the media as having won the battle of the streets. But what was the cost? What does it mean for New York next week? Timoney, now CEO of a private security firm that's been brought in to help deal with the protests and protect the corporate executives who will be at the Waldorf Astoria for this 3,000-person event inside a gathering of global financial chiefs. We hoped we would have John Timoney on the line with us today. He said he would join us, but unfortunately, he's not yet rung through. During the RNC, the police made mass preemptive detentions and arrests in order to keep the streets clean of demonstrators. But even as the major media wallowed in accounts of Timoney's deft and restrained policing, reports of serious civil rights violations and abuse by police mounted. Over 400 protesters were arrested and detained, along with innocent bystanders, bike messengers, a photographer for U.S. News and World Report. According to the legal team, R2K, the umbrella group that organized the protests, most of those arrested were held for over 60 hours before being arraigned on misdemeanor charges that normally would warrant no more than a desk appearance ticket. Almost all the charges against the arrested protesters were dropped. in what seemed a systematic campaign by the police and city officials to lock up suspected ringleaders until after the Democratic convention in Los Angeles a few weeks later. Philadelphia prosecutors obtained unprecedented bail of $1 million for two prominent organizers. One of them is John Sellers, a former Greenpeace activist, now director of Ruckus Society based in Berkeley, which has trained thousands of nonviolent protesters. Sellers' bail was later reduced to $100,000. He now has a lawsuit pending against the Philadelphia Police Department and joins us from Berkeley. John Sellers, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy. How are you doing?
It's great to have you with us. Will you be in New York? I don't know if you can say this next week.
I'm actually going to be going down to Porto Alegre for the World Social Forum next week.
And actually, we're going to go down to Brazil in a minute to talk with one of the organizers of that. She's in the Amazon right now organizing people for that gathering. But when you heard that John Timoney was coming to New York to join with Ray Kelly, the police commissioner now under the new mayor, Bloomberg, what were your thoughts going back to your own experiences in Philadelphia?
Well, yeah, I just heard about it a couple of days ago and read the piece in the Village Voice. And, you know, it's obviously a great concern to me because, you know, as we pursue particularly the civil cases in Philadelphia, just more and more of the underhanded, preemptive, unconstitutional tactics that Timoney and the Philadelphia police and the state police, FBI, utilized against dissent are, you know, coming clear in the wash, and it's a really scary thing to look at.
What about this issue? Kate Cooper joins us in the studio right now with Another World Is Possible, of preemptive detentions as a possible tactic here in New York.
Well, it's a tactic that we see the police use a lot. These sweeps of mass arrests that get peaceful protesters off the street, and later the charges are almost always dropped. Right now in Philly, there are about 7 civil suits pending against the city and a class action suit. And in Seattle, the protesters who were arrested in Seattle just won a multi-million-dollar class action suit against the city, which is not something you hear much about. But I think it's part of this greater effort that we're seeing since September 11th to clamp down on our civil rights and our right to speak out against global injustice.
John Sellers, on the issue of why you were held, they talked about you having an instrument of crime. What was that instrument?
I have that instrument today. That's how I'm speaking to you, Amy. It was my cell phone. They put that down as my instrument of crime. I think it's interesting to note that I'm not sure if this is happening in New York City, but in Philadelphia, the city actually took out an insurance policy. We're not quite sure of the figures. It looks like it was over $500,000 to protect itself against civil rights and other cases, other legal cases pending from their behavior during the RNC, which, you know, usually the city insures itself. They took out a policy, it's a $3 million policy, which covers any legal expenses incurred in defending itself against the citizens that, you know, have a real legitimate beef for the unconstitutional behavior of the city. So, you know, we can probably expect to see something like that in New York City.
We also have on the line with us Maisa Mendonça, who is one of the organizers of the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre. Right now, she is in the Amazon. Maisa, thank you for joining us.
Sure, you're welcome.
As you listen to the people in our studio on the phone right now preparing for the protests in New York, there's going to be a different scene in Porto Alegre. Can you describe what the plans are there that are taking place for the very reason that the World Economic Forum is taking place in New York?
Yes, actually the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre is a mix of debate, conferences to discuss alternatives to the neoliberal model of globalization, as well as street protests. We will have a big march, a very large march against the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. We will have a very large tribunal against the debt to look at third world debt organized by Jubilee South. In addition to that, we will have 27 conferences, over 100 seminars, over 700 workshops, in addition to all the cultural events, concerts, film festivals, theater festivals. So it's a mix of debate and also protest.
And why are you in the Amazon right now? Where are you exactly?
Actually, I'm in the city of Belém, which is the state capital of the state of Pará. And it's one of the most violent states. Only last year, between September and November, in 3 months, 8 landless leaders were killed here in this state. But the state capital is governed by the Workers' Party. The city government is also, the mayor is from the Workers' Party. So we are organizing a pre-event. It's the Amazon Social Forum to discuss issues related to the region. So we have people from Venezuela, Colombia, the Guianas, and we will talk about U.S. intervention, Plan Colombia, the situation in Venezuela, indigenous rights, women's rights, and other issues, even hip-hop in the Amazon. So we will have about 100 different workshops and also different kinds of events to discuss specific issues in the region, in the Amazon region, to prepare for the World Social Forum.
Richard Esposito here in New York, a voice writer for Lockdown at the Waldorf for the parallel event that is happening in New York, the World Economic Forum. Your piece presents a picture of violent riots at anti-globalization protests and paints a picture of an Al-Qaeda-like network of activists. Have you been following any of these demonstrations?
I followed what the police have said about a core group of demonstrators, not the mass of protesters. And I think we tried to make very clear it's a couple of hundred people that they feel have taken advantage of legitimate protests to do things that they find unacceptable, whether it's turn over car service cars or spray paint a historical building in Philadelphia. They just don't feel they have the time for that, and they don't feel they're going to let that happen in New York. My feeling is, the instinct is, that that's not going to happen here. Our police have a pretty good track record over time of not doing that. I've already pointed out the instances where they have not had a good track record, whether it's Crown Heights or back at Sydenham Hospital in the early 80s.
John Sellers, what is your thought about that sort of picture, which isn't unusual, of kind of linking anti-corporate globalization protesters with Al-Qaeda or even Taliban?
Well, you know, I think it's a strategy of folks on the right side of the fence. I mean, you had Don Young from the senator from Alaska right after the tragedies of 9/11, pointing to the anti-globalization movement, saying, you know, we should be looking here for the perpetrators of this act. The more they can make us look like terrorists, the more they can paint us in the corner and make us look unreasonable and violent, then the easier it is to vilify us, to criminalize us, to brutalize us with impunity, you know, that we're not going to be of concern to the American public.
Kate Cooper.
Respond to that?
Yes.
To agree with what John just said, I think that Richard's article goes a long way to vilify us. The article is very one-sided. Richard doesn't speak to a single demonstrator or a single activist in his article. There are numerous factual errors in the article about violence that took place in Melbourne, Genoa, Seattle. And it's not clear. Richard just said that he tries to make it clear that he's talking about a small group of protesters, but the article doesn't make that clear at all. It paints a sensationalist image of our movement as a whole and focuses on it paints an image of anarchists and protesters as bloodthirsty rioters, and I think that's really dangerous in the climate of New York right now. It's very dangerous and irresponsible.
Kate, it says in simple sentence that it's under 200 people that they're talking about, first of all. Second of all, unless I misunderstand what I wrote, it says the police killed somebody in Genoa. It says that in Melbourne, they stopped. I'm going to just go over the facts as I stated them. In Melbourne, it says, and you can tell me if this isn't true, that they stopped the opening of the event. That's neither violent nor outside of their rights. But because police kill somebody, you don't get to wash your hands of that if you help them do it. I don't really like violence of any kind, whether it's on the part of police or on the part of protesters. And I don't have a lot of time for it myself. As someone who's engaged in protest and all of those things, I'm not interested in violence.
Okay, what you say, you don't say that the police killed an activist?
No, I said
in
they did.
Genoa.
I said they did.
I mean in your article, Richard. You say that a young anarchist was slain using the passive voice. What
by
happened
police.
In...
is the rest of the sentence.
By
just finish
Carabinieri.
Right.
What happened in Genoa, though, it's a little more complicated than that. Protesters were pushing at a fence, and all of a sudden the gate flew open, and a military vehicle barreled through the crowd, just like ran straight into a crowd of protesters. And when a protester raised, it was a fire extinguisher, which, he raised this fire extinguisher. They shot him point blank, and the police in Genoa, the Carabinieri, had made a commitment to not have live ammunition. So, that's one factual error. And
that's not an error of fact. I don't say any of those things. There's a lot of serious articles been written about this.
Well, there are clearly, there are factual errors
I said
in your
the police,
article, Richard.
You haven't pointed one out yet, and they might be.
Okay,
but
noxious chemicals were used in Melbourne by the police, not by protesters. Those noxious chemicals to which you refer are tear gas and pepper spray. Urine was not used. Water cannons in Seattle 99. Water cannons have never been used by protesters in the U.S. I believe they were used.
I don't think it says protesters used them.
It doesn't, but that's the implication.
Okay. It does
the
not
implication,
say police used them. It does but, not say protesters used them.
By leaving out the specificity of that, you imply in these four bullet points
okay,
about violence.
Right. The four bullet points. It's a summary as best you can do in four paragraphs of what's gone on before. The article's about what's
and
to come in New York.
And you skillfully leave out certain specific details that make all the violence fall on the shoulders of the protesters.
I think it says that the police in Philadelphia did all of the things you said they did. They charged $1 million bail. They did excessive arrest in advance. I think it spells that out clearly.
Right, but...
But the point is, the article's about what's going to happen here next week.
No, I
And it's
don't
what the police say they're going to do here next
well,
week.
Well, let's talk about what the plans of the protesters are as opposed to the police right now.
Okay.
What are the different demonstrations, educational forums that are planned in New York? Democracy Now! Will be there. We'll be broadcasting both from Brazil, from Porto Alegre, as well as New York.
There's a variety of activities planned. There's a vigil organized by AWIP, the In Other Worlds Possible Coalition, and the Pagan Cluster, co-sponsored on Friday night. On Saturday, there are several demonstrations, one by AWIP, one by Reclaim the Streets, one by the IAC, and the Students for Global Justice of Columbia University and other student groups around the country.
Now, I understand that the students at Columbia University are having a very tough time right now pulling off their forum as they get serious pressure from the administration. First, it was to call it off totally, now moving into much smaller spaces to make it hard for large groups of people to have this educational
And they've
forum.
Also they've made some very unreasonable demands. They've asked for the names of every single person who could possibly attend these workshops, their political affiliations, that they wear badges at all times, that security know which workshops they would attend, and security also was requesting information for off-campus events as well as on-campus events.
Is this a concern to you, Richard Esposito?
To be honest, I haven't followed the Columbia event. Those, for a university, does it sound, the way Kate's put it, excessive? Yeah. The concern that Kate raised earlier, and the place where I would agree with Kate, is do you create an atmosphere where protest is limited? And that's really, to me, the key question. It's not about a minority. It's about whether the majority of people can demonstrate and have their rights observed.
I want to end with Maísa Mendonça, who is in the Amazon right now, one of the organizers of the World Social Forum. And the reason for the World Social Forum to begin with, where you expect between, 20 and 40,000 people to gather?
Yes, we actually will have about 13 delegates and 10,000 people in the youth camp in addition to all the other participants. So we are expecting about 40,000 people. And the reason is to show that
our movement, our international movement against neoliberal globalization, uses street protests as a legitimate way to express what we want. At the same time, we have particular alternatives. We have concrete experiences that show that it's possible to build a different world. It's possible to build a different economic model that respects human rights, social justice. So we need to think that it's possible to change the way things are moving in terms of building peace in the world. One thing we are going to stress this year is that we can only build peace if we fight against oppression. So oppression is going to be a center piece in our debate here in Porto Alegre. And regarding to the meeting here in the Amazon, one key issue for us here in Brazil that I think is important for people in the U.S. to know is that the U.S. government is trying to use a military base in the Amazon as part of its intervention in the Amazon region with Plan Colombia, with the base in Ecuador, the Manta base, and now it's going to set up a base here in the middle of the Amazon in the state of Maranhão. And this base will displace several traditional Afro-Brazilian communities that come from the times of slavery. They have been resisting in this land for over 200 years, and now we are fighting for the rights of these communities here in Brazil. Well, so these are the kinds of issues we are going to be talking about.
Well, Maísa Mendonça, I want to thank you very much for joining us from the Amazon as you head also next week to Porto Alegre, organizer for the World Social Forum in Brazil. Also, John Sellers on the line with us from Berkeley, director of the Rucka Society. He's headed down to Brazil. And here in our Firehouse studio, we've been joined by Richard Esposito, a consulting producer for ABC News, wrote the piece in this week's Village Voice, Lockdown at the Waldorf. And there is a field guide to anti-World Economic Forum protest in New York City in this week's Village Voice that lays out the different events, some of the different events that will be taking place. And finally, Kate Cooper, who is with Another World is Possible, one of the protesters who will be out on the streets next week, will be there as well. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute with singer-songwriter activist Adar Williams.
Once upon a time, there was a nuclear family, and we lived in family time. We'd unite in a family way. And off in the ancient mountain, they were splitting every nucleus. But they said, don't be alarmed. They said, just don't try this at home. And they were the mystery that made the world run. And we had the power because they were the sun. And we called them our heroes. And the future had come. They said, look at the light we're giving you. And the darkness that we're saving you from. And soon they were bringing it into our showroom. And they'd unveil it with its title, bring your family, it's the great unknown. You can look, but you can't fathom, it's the great unknown.
Adar Williams here in our Firehouse studio at Democracy Now!, and you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Adar is one of today's most acclaimed singer-songwriters, a folk artist in the tradition of Joan Baez, Joni Mitchell, Utah Phillips. She has said of her music, I hope I'm writing songs that go into the niches and places other people don't. But she has one song that holds a special place in the hearts of us engaged in the struggle to save grassroots community radio, a song she wrote about the influence of New York Pacifica station WBAI. It's called Are You Out There? Since the early 1990s, Dar has been combining a fierce dedication to social justice with a deeply personal sensibility in her music. Indeed, has raised her powerful three-octave voice for an array of progressive movements, from Pacifica to in the environment to women's rights to anti-corporate global justice. In the process, she's created a unique sound where the personal intersects with the political, past traditions merge with the present, and struggle melts into humor. Dar, welcome to the program.
And
if you wouldn't mind starting off with, Are You Out There?
Here we go.
Perhaps I am a miscreation. No one knows the truth. There is no future here. And you're the DJ, speaks to my insomnia and laughs at all I had to fear. Laughs at all I had to fear. You always play the Madman Poets, vinyl vision, grungy bands. You never know who's still awake. You never know who understands. And are you out there? Can you hear this? Jimmy Olsen, Johnny Memphis. I was out here listening all the time. And though the static walls surround me, you were out there and you found me. I was out here listening all the time. Last night we drank in parking lots. And why do we drink? I guess we do it 'cause. And when I turned your station on, you sounded more familiar than that party was. You were more familiar than that party. It's the first time I stayed up all night. It's getting late, I hear the birds. I'm driving home on empty streets. I think I put my shirt on backwards. Are you out there? Can you hear this? Jimmy Olsen, Johnny Memphis. I was out here listening all the time. And though the static walls surround me, you were out there and you found me. I was out here listening all the time. And what's the future? Who will choose it? Politics of love and music. Underdogs who turn the tables. Indie versus major labels. There's so much to see through. Like our parents do more drugs than we do. Whoa, 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 whoa. Corporate parents, corporate town. I know every TV set that's got them lit. They preach that I should save the world. They pray that I won't do a better job of it. Pray that I won't do a better job. So tonight I turned your station on just so I'd be understood. Instead, another voice said I was just too late and just no good. Calling Olsen, calling Memphis, I am calling. Can you hear this? I was out here listening all the time. And I will write this down and then I will not be alone again. Yeah, I was out here listening. Oh yeah, I was out here listening. Oh yeah, I am out here listening all the time.
Are You Out There? Dar Williams in the garret of a firehouse in Chinatown, just blocks from Ground Zero. Thank you, Dar.
Thank you.
So tell us about the song and why you wrote it.
I grew up in Chappaqua, New York, which is where the Clintons live now. And
did they take your house?
No, they're on the other side of the tracks, as it were.
I won't ask which side.
They're kind of the same in Chappaqua, but they're on the other side. And growing up, it was it was just a lot slower growing up. You know, my parents moved there in 1965, and it got more and more. It got faster and faster, and I was a teenager during the Reagan era, and things really changed at that point. And in the midst of that, of all these people building, you know, three-car garages and buying guns and stuff, we had these hippie teachers who kept on saying, you know, there's more to the world than you're seeing in this town, in this conservative town. And one day I was listening to the radio, and I found WBAI. And it was coming in so crackly, as if the suburbs were trying to keep it out as much as possible. I thought, this must be the real world they're talking about. And I started listening. And actually, one of the first things I would listen to at 6 o'clock in the morning was a reading of The War of the Worlds, which was H.G. Wells' story, which shows how freeform they were. And so I never knew what to expect, and I just loved it. So this is sort of a song from my and to my teenage self about my exposure to this wonderful to WBAI and the Pacifica family after that.
Well, in the song you just sang, you said, "What's the future? Who will choose it? Politics of love and music, underdogs who turn the tables, indie versus major labels. There's so much to see through, like our parents do more drugs than we do." You actually got your start in the coffee houses of Boston and Cambridge in the 1990s. You recorded your first collection of songs, The Honesty Room, on your own homegrown label. Talk about indie labels versus the corporate media and record companies.
It's a terrific thing to explore. I mean, it's something that I feel like I got a crash course in commercial culture by doing by going indie. There are certain perks that you don't get from certain nods that you don't get from the commercial media, but or from the major labels. But then there's a lot of resonance in the career that you do have with where everything builds pretty organically. And I don't know where I got the nerve or the strong motivation to stay indie. How I got such a deep distrust of the major labels, except that I knew people who had been burnt by them, and I knew I didn't want to be forgotten by them. I'd rather have a career that just sort of grew on its own terms. And in Boston, there were a lot of people starting to make their own CDs. The ability to make your own CD really started a groundswell of people doing their own thing and marketing their own thing. And with their own computers, they could make CD covers and mass manufacture them at a copy store and do it by themselves, which gave us a lot more breathing room to decide if we wanted to make the next step to a major label distribution situation or to stay indie to some degree or another.
Tell us about Waterbug Records.
Waterbug was Andrew Calhoun in Chicago, and he had about six other artists at the time that I was there, and it was just him in his basement and with his vision. He's a visionary and also a singer-songwriter, and the thing about the people like that you work with is that you remember them for the work they did, but also I remember he and I read, I asked him if he believed in evil, and he took out A Wrinkle in Time, and he started to read me the end of A Wrinkle in Time, and then he started crying so hard he had to give it to his wife, and she started crying so hard she couldn't read it, so she gave it to me, and I started crying so hard, and he said, I do believe in evil, but I do believe in love, and it was just, that's the kind of thing that you get from working at that level, going down to his basement and watching all the envelopes that he was sealing to send my stuff out to the folk radio stations.
Can you sing us another song, your choice?
Sure. Let's do this one.
Dar Williams.
This is the song that started me out on Waterbug. This is why Andrew invited me to be a part of his label. It's called When I Was a Boy.
I won't forget when Peter Pan came to my house, took my hand, I said I was a boy, I'm glad he didn't check. I learned to fly, I learned to fight, I lived a whole life in one night, we saved each other's lives out on the pirate deck. And I remember that night when leaving a late night with some friends, and I hear somebody tell me it's not safe, someone should help me. I need to find a nice man to walk me home. When I was a boy, I scared the pants off of my mom, climbed what I could climb up. And I don't know how I survived. I guess I knew the tricks that all boys knew. And you can walk me home. But I was a boy too. I was a kid that she would like, just a small boy on her bike, riding topless. Yeah, I never cared who saw. My neighbor came outside to say, get your shirt. I said, no way, it's the last time, I am not breaking any law. And now I'm in this clothing store, and the signs say less is more. More that's tight means more to see, more for them, not more for me. That can help me climb a tree 10 seconds flat. When I was a boy, see that picture, that was me, grass stained shirt and dusty knees. And I know things I gotta change. They got pills to sell, they got implants to put in, they got implants to remove. But I am not forgetting that I was a boy too. And like the woods where I would creep, it's a secret I can keep. Except when I'm tired, except when I'm being caught off guard. And I've had a lonesome, awful day. The conversation finds its way to catching fireflies out in the backyard. And so I tell the man I'm with about the other life I lived. And I say, now you're Top Gun, I have lost and you have won. And he says, oh no, oh no, can't you see? When I was a girl, my mom and I, we always talked, and I picked flowers everywhere that I walked. And I could always cry, now even when I'm alone, I seldom do. And I have lost some kindness, but I was a girl too, and you were just like me, and I was just like you.
Dar Williams singing in our Firehouse studio. Dar, you can keep singing as we go out. And if you'd like to get an audio cassette of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. And a fond farewell to Chris for a few days, who's headed down to Porto Alegre. Deepa Fernandez is in our studio. Hopefully she'll be coming to join us soon. She'll be in Porto Alegre as well. And thank you to Mario Murillo, who connected us with Maisa Mendonca. He'll be in Porto Alegre as well. All of them reporting for us on Democracy Now! It's been wonderful having Dar in the studio. Our website is democracynow.org, broadcasting from downtown community television. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!